What we should not do is to use the legal system to inflict outcomes that we know to be unjust merely in the name of the law. We should not do that. Since the law has no intrinsic authority, whatever moral import is to be found in upholding the law must derive from the just and good outcomes that result from doing so. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today we'll be discussing Justice Before the Law by Michael Humer. He is a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado in America. Mr. Humer, where is the best place to get the book?
Yeah, well, you can order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or, you know, I assume any bookseller.
Those links will be in the description below. Dr. Humer, what is justice?
Well, that's somewhat of a complex question because there are different kinds of justice, but in the context of the legal system, justice is a matter of giving people what they deserve and respecting their rights. So in the case of somebody who has committed a crime, what they deserve is punishment that's proportionate to the crime. Innocent people deserve to be released, and everybody has a right not to be punished for things that they didn't do, things like that. In civil cases, what people deserve is somebody who did a wrong should have to pay compensation to the person they harmed.
And a lot of time when people are discussing the law, sometimes it's natural law or moral law. Sometimes it's legislation by the state in a given geographical area. What do you mean by the law in this case?
Well, I was mostly thinking about the government created law, but, the law is the rules that are accepted in your society, roughly speaking. So, and they are not necessarily morally correct, right? So, there is in fact a law against using recreational drugs. This law is wrong, but it's still a law, right? Because, that's the thing that was passed by the legislature.
Do citizens that live in a country and benefit from the society as a whole have an obligation to obey the country's laws?
Well, it depends upon what the law is, right? Depends upon whether the law is just or unjust, right? So you have an obligation to obey the just laws and not the unjust laws, right? And, the unjust laws should be circumvented if possible.
And how are, what are some methods we could use to differentiate just laws from unjust laws?
Yeah, there's a good theory about this. It's libertarianism. So, unjust laws are laws that violate people's rights, that punish people who haven't violated anybody's rights and haven't done anything wrong. So, what rights do people have? I don't really have a complete list of people's rights, but a general thing is, you have a right not to be harmfully coerced, provided that you're not doing anything wrong to any other particular person, right?
And how would you differentiate between positive and negative rights? Do you think that any positive rights are morally justified?
I don't think I believe in any positive rights. So I can't think of a good example of a positive right that I would accept. So, just in case anyone doesn't know, I don't know. So positive rights are rights to receive some benefit from someone. Negative rights are rights not to be mistreated in some way.
One of the main justifications for why people should follow the law is what Thomas Sowell loosely refers to as the constrained vision, that humans are generally getting knowledge from a very widely dispersed source of a lot of actions of a lot of different people. And the likelihood of you being able to determine what is correct, as opposed to a process that's gone on for hundreds and thousands of years before you, it's much more likely to have the right answer if you delegate to a presumed authority rather than everyone trying to do things themselves. What are your thoughts on why people should make these decisions themselves as opposed to delegating to judges and officers who've been doing this for hundreds of years?
Yeah, the first part of that sounded reasonable, right? Like, oh, if there's a process that has been going on for hundreds or thousands of years, and, you know, a lot of people have been cooperating, then, you know, it's going to be hard for you individually to do better than that. But then second part of that seemed to be like unrelated, right? Because, I mean, the laws that we have are just the laws that some politicians voted for. And, you know, most of them are not hundreds or thousands of years old. We're in the US, where only, you know, the whole country is only 200 years old or whatever, 250 or something. So legislators can easily go against traditions that were longstanding, right? And like, you know, throw out rights that we used to have and just like make up some new rule. And so, you know, like a good question would be, why should we trust them, right? Like, why think these random politicians who won a popularity contest, and by the way, are not even that popular, right? They only won because people didn't like the politician on the other side, right? You know, why would we think that they have all this wisdom?
Yeah, when I was asking non-libertarians about the book, a lot of them were that they gave me, the big takeaway was they have extremely high standards for those in the private sector and those questioning the state, and virtually no standards for politicians, judges, and policemen. So they're really curious as to, down to the last detail, what your ultimate justification is for not initiating violence, but for, you know, politicians putting people in jail for decades. It's like, yeah, they're not really interested. Whatever's going on, they probably have thought of it. How is it that in a world that gave us Aristotle a very long time ago, people are still not having any standards for public officials, but extremely high standards for people in the private sector?
Yeah, good question, right? Although, you know, when you mention Aristotle, like, he wasn't exactly great on justice, so to speak, right? That is, that he thought that slavery was just, and, you know, the right way to acquire your slaves is by going to war, whatever. Anyway, in my previous book, The Problem of Political Authority, there's a chapter about psychology and about the various different biases that people are subject to, which help to support the state. I mean, maybe the biggest thing is there's just this status quo bias. And I guess I would say, there's sort of a bias for the powerful. Like, whoever has power, people instinctively want to align themselves with that person or that group, right? And so I suspect this might be an adaptation, you know, evolutionarily. And so, you know, like, you just see that the state has power, so you want to align yourself with them. Probably in the past, people who questioned the powerful and disagreed with them and criticized them, we're less successful for, you know, some straightforward reasons, like probably the powerful people suppressed them and maybe even killed them. So, you know, that's probably what we're left with now, that we have this bias.
What are agent-centered constraints, and why is it important to know about them?
Yeah, so, you know, there are moral constraints on how you can treat other people. And some of them are agent-centered, as they say in ethical theory, meaning that it's not permissible to violate the constraint, even if doing so would prevent, you know, some comparable violations by other people. So, like, it's generally taken to be impermissible to murder an innocent person, even if you're murdering the innocent person, prevents someone else from murdering two innocent people. Right. Okay. So, you know, agent-centered, meaning that it's the constraint on how you, the agent, treat other people. So you have to think of your own violation of the constraint differently from other people's violation, meaning you're responsible for making sure that you don't violate it. You're not responsible in the same way for making sure that other people don't violate it.
What methods can we use to judge whether or not a punishment is proportionate to a crime committed?
One thing you could think about is, so if you have a legitimate crime, then somebody should have been hurt by it. So, you know, one thing you could think about is, would I rather be subjected to such and such sentence or be subjected to this crime? Mm-hmm. Right? And if your answer is like, I would rather get that sentence, then the sentence is too light, right? If the answer is, wow, I would rather suffer that crime, you know, 10 times over, then the sentence is probably too harsh, right? You know, so you could think about that, right? Like, so, you know, if somebody stole some money, then it's kind of easy. It's easy to see what's proportionate. Like, he should have to pay it back, maybe also pay extra, like, to, you know, to cover the costs of enforcing the law against him and stuff like that.
When, if ever, would someone be justified in arresting and imprisoning another person?
Well, so, you know, arresting, just if somebody violated somebody else's rights, that seems okay. I mean, if you're asking, like, what crimes deserve prison sentences, my view is it should only be serious violent crimes. So if you just committed a property crime, so like the people who are in prison now, there's violent criminals, which I think are maybe 40%, a little bit under half. And then there are property criminals, and then there's drug criminals. So I think the property criminals and the drug criminals basically shouldn't be in prison unless they refuse to comply with non-prison sanctions. Right. So basically the drug criminals should get no sentence at all. And then the property criminals should be required to pay compensation. Right. And, you know, maybe a little bit extra, you know, just to make sure that they're deterred, that it wasn't worth it to try committing the property crime. Right. And only if they refuse to pay, then should they go to prison. Right. But, you know, I mean, we just have way too many people in prison. We're like the world leader in incarcerating people.
I'm aware of that statistic. I'm just curious if that is enough. Maybe the U.S. is that much better at catching the bad guys than everyone else. Maybe we're number one. I certainly see a lot of a lot of criminals go free. Why do you think that there's so many resources allocated to something like the drug war? What would be the state's incentive to have a war on drugs?
Well, I mean, I guess that drug users are unpopular, so politicians can sort of posture about this. But, you know, another thing is, like, at the level of police departments, it's probably easier to capture drug sellers than to capture violent criminals. And, you know, it's probably safer on the cops, right? So, you know, like, we have there's a former cop who's a student here that I talked to, and he was basically describing how it was easier to get the drug criminals because, like, there's this house where there will be a house where you know that they sell the drugs, and you can just wait there for the drug criminals to come out. And, you know, like, the police, just they get evaluated on how many arrests they make and, you know, how many convictions result and things like that. So, you know, just go for the easy arrests.
It can kind of be discouraging when you talk to a lot of people. They don't have great justifications for things like the drug war. However, it doesn't seem like this is really on the politicians' agenda to repeal these unjust laws. What are some things that people can do to, you know, I don't know if change the law is the right way to go about it, but to decrease the likelihood people will continue to get caged for this victimless crime?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, there's, what, so to speak, propagandistic methods. You could just go and talk about it more. The other thing is, you know, if you get on a jury for a drug case, so if you're called for jury service for a drug case, you know, the first thing is you have to lie and say, you have to say that you will do whatever the judge says, and otherwise they will exclude you from the jury. So you have to say that you will just apply the law. And then after you do that and get on the jury, then you should vote to acquit, right? Now, I think that this sometimes happens, but I don't know how often. I think nobody knows how often. Because, you know, the juries don't have to give an explanation when they, if they acquit, they don't have to give any explanation of why. So, but I think that occasionally that happens right now in our system, that, you know, somebody just gets acquitted because of the drug laws are unpopular. Right? Or actually more often a hung jury, we get a hung jury.
And do hung juries result in, I'm ashamed I don't know this, do they result in retrials?
Yeah, they would normally try it again. So the person will probably wind up going to prison because the next jury will probably vote to convict, but not necessarily. You know, maybe he'll have better luck. Maybe he'll get an acquittal the next time. Don't really know. But if there are a lot of hung juries for a certain kind of crime, then prosecutors are going to stop going after it.
In your many decades of research, have you come across a general theory as to why, what makes people change their mind or change their position on certain topics?
Well, I'm not sure, because people almost never change their minds when you're talking to them. They almost never tell you, oh yeah, you convinced me, that's right. But I have some reason to think that people sometimes change their minds because, like, you know, some people have told me, like people have said on Facebook that I convinced them about something, but they didn't say anything at the time. Like, so, you know, one thing is the people who are loudest and that you hear from most are probably least likely to change their minds. And like, if you're having conversations online or something, it's more likely that people who are reading the conversation but not participating, that they might be influenced by the arguments, right? I think like a person who is not decided to begin with, like then it's easy for arguments to influence them. Somebody who has a definite opinion, I'm not sure. I guess I would say, you know, like one thing is you have to think about why they hold the view they do and make a serious effort to address their actual reasons, right? Not just like ignore it or, you know, just talk about your, like what convinced you, but also think about what convinced them.
Yeah. The reason it's just something that's so on my radar is I'm very disillusioned by people justifying things like lockdowns or drug wars after decades or after 20 years and trillions of dollars wasted in Afghanistan, not to mention Iraq. People would like the next week were like, you know, we should really go into Australia. Because the military definitely should. Bill Kristol has called for regime change in China, the guy who said the Iraq war is going to last 2 months. So, I mean, it's like they have no humility besides reason and logic. Ayn Rand said the argument from intimidation, anytime you show disapproval, will increase someone's insecurity in their position. Do you have any other, maybe, I hate to say this, non-rational methods to get people to stop justifying initiating violence?
I don't know. I'm not so good at the non-rational methods, I guess, right? You know, yeah, I guess you can express disapproval like, oh, this is really bad. Actually, I guess, I mean, sort of appealing to people's emotions. And I think, I mean, this isn't really non-rational, I don't think, actually. Like, if you're appealing to appropriate emotions, that are the appropriate reaction to something bad happening. So like, you could tell stories about stuff that happened to people because of the drug war or whatever it is. I think the reason why America got out of Vietnam had to do with kind of emotional appeals, right? When people saw photographs of what it was like. So like they knew intellectually what was happening, but they, you know, you see pictures of villages being bombed or whatever, children running from their burning village.
And then had
more of an impact.
That's an excellent point. I can remember, you know, the murder of Kelly Thomas. If you ever saw that police like murder this guy on security camera, or Eric Garner, whereas like, you know, the millions killed by King Leopold. And even in the First World War, as much as I hate it and I'm against it, it doesn't get me really passionate like those others do. So, yes, great reference there. Back to the book, the Marshall Project, quoting the Bureau of Justice Statistics, says that 77% of prisoners reoffend within the first 5 years, referring to state and federal prisoners combined. What are some alternatives to prison that could do away with crime or decrease the likelihood that crime exists, certainly violent crime?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the first thing I want to say is like, we should not be overly optimistic So like, I think it's easy for people to sort of get utopian and start imagining ways that we're going to like totally change criminals and make them into nice, productive members of society, whatever, make them into nice people. It's actually really hard. And actually, you know, even though the state screws up a lot of things, if there was an easy way to make nobody commit crimes, we would be doing it. Okay, but anyway, so it's not possible to like, you know, I don't think there's any known program that's super effective. It is possible to do, I think it's possible to do better than we are doing, okay? So like the rehabilitation programs that have at least, you know, more success involve teaching people some, getting them doing some kind of productive work, right? Teaching them some valuable job skills. But, you know, I mean, what I really think is like for property criminals, as I say, that I don't think they should be in prison. I think they should just have to pay compensation. Violent criminals, I think like we have a good reason to put them in prison. In fact, I mean, in some cases, I think they're just like unfixable. So like, I think something like a quarter of the prison population is thought to be psychopaths, which basically is unfixable. There's basically nothing you can do but just hold them in prison. And then, right? And, you know, like in some cases, they just have to be there until they die, right? Because, you know, if they commit serious violent crimes, because there's just no way, there's just no way to cure them.
Shows like 60 Days In and, you know, these inside prison systems, you can see that they don't really have anything for the inmates to do. So you're not surprised when like 50% of their waking time is discussed about how they're going to, you know, get drugs, how they're going to transfer drugs, how they're going to, you know, make this like liquid alcohol in a box with a bag on the outside. It's terrible that their time isn't occupied with anything. As a philosopher, if I put you in charge of a jail, what are some things you would do to increase the likelihood that the savable people would have a productive time in prison and be less likely to commit violent offenses when they come out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the way you started that question is a little funny because as a philosopher, what the hell do I know about that? Like, you should ask a social scientist, right? I mean, but yeah, my minimal knowledge is that there are some rehabilitation programs that have some success, some limited success, and they involve, you know, making them do work, right? Teaching them some useful skill and then having them do that. And they get paid, you know, a small amount, you know, paid less than you would get on the outside, but they get paid something for doing that. And then, you know, maybe they could be spending most of their day doing something productive, right?
Would a police officer who, unlike the average person, has taken an oath to uphold the law, would they be morally obligated to do so because they've taken an oath?
No. So, you know, here's an analogy, right? Okay, some people will not like this analogy, but anyway, let's say that you joined the mafia and, you know, you promised to help enforce the boss's will. And, you know, you promised to help him by beating up people who refused to pay protection money. You promised. So now, does that mean, like, does that give you a moral justification for beating up the people who don't pay protection money? No. Like, if it was that easy to circumvent morality, you know, like, there would be no point to morality, right? All you have to do is promise to violate a moral principle, and then you get to do it, right? So, you know, like, part of the point here is, a promise to do something that's immoral is not binding. You don't get the obligation or an excuse to do the immoral thing. Another thing to say is, I mean, cops have a certain amount of discretion. They don't have to arrest everyone that they can. So, you know, they could just give somebody a warning. So if you see somebody, you know, using illegal drugs, I think you should just like warn them not to do that in front of police. And then, you know, I think like if you do that a lot, you might get in trouble with your boss or with your partner or whatever. But the thing is, like, you know, that's also true if you're in the mafia and you don't want to beat up the people who don't pay protection money, you'll get in trouble. But that still doesn't mean that it's okay to do it.
I know. I should have thought of that when cops pulled me over. I wasn't just selling drugs on my own fruition. I was told to do so. I took an oath to sell these. Goodbye. I'm sure they really would have understood. There is a general theory that it's not crime that is the problem. Crime is the result of poverty, and poverty is the problem. Do you see a strong correlation that exists as a causal result of poverty creating crime?
Well, I mean, so there's a well-known correlation between poverty and crime. And, you know, like a lot of people infer that means that crime is caused by poverty. You know, and it probably contributes, but I don't think that it's the main cause. So here's another explanation of this correlation. Maybe there's a third factor that causes both. And in particular, maybe there are certain personality traits that cause both criminal behavior and poverty. Like, for example, having poor impulse control and poor long-term planning and lack of respect for social rules. Notice how all of those things would make it hard to get a job, and they would also get you in trouble with the law. So, I think that's a plausible explanation of the correlation. You know, another thing is if you commit crimes, like crime could cause poverty. Like if you commit crimes, then maybe you get fired from your job because you committed a crime at work. And so now you're poor because you don't have a job, right? And in general, I think that sort of people on the left like to portray the problem as a lot easier than it is. Big social problems are usually hard. Like social problems that have been around for as long as human society has existed are probably hard to solve. It's probably not going to be simple, like, oh, just like give everybody a basic income, there'll be no crime. It's not that simple, right? There are people who have like aggressive impulses, and they're just going to like fight with other people just because they feel aggression. And that's just not, you know, it's not going to be that easily fixed. You know, similarly, like it's not so easy as saying, oh, let's just teach people to respect each other. Like, well, some people just don't take the lesson, okay? There's a certain amount of people who are just like genetically predisposed to aggression. And, you know, like psychopathy is largely genetic. So, you know, it's just, you know, just not going to be fixed that easily. Like, I mean, the reason why left-wing people like to say this thing about poverty causing crime is that they want to justify government social welfare programs where the government takes a bunch of money from the rich and gives it to the poor. So they like to say, oh, see, that's going to solve crime. And, you know, wish that was true, but it's just not that easy.
Yeah. Do you know if it even is true that poverty is highly correlated with crime, just because the crimes that I, you know, often read about are the military industrial complex, Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, politicians, it's like some of the richest people on planet Earth committing the biggest crime. So it's not like, well, if you give people money, then they won't be criminals. The richest people on the planet are some of the most evil in certainly in the involuntary sector. Is there really a strong correlation between poverty and crime?
I think there is. I mean, you might worry that like white collar crimes are undercounted, so that's possible. But you know, like everything I've heard is that there's a pretty strong correlation. Now, what you were talking about, I mean, you're talking about like, I guess, property crimes. Some of them might be sort of questionable whether they should be crimes, like whatever insider trading or something like that. I think violent crime is strongly correlated with poverty. And I think generally like there are like high profile crimes, you know, like on Wall Street, but I think they're a small minority, right? Like, yeah. I think the majority of wealthy people are just like, whatever, following the rules. Because I mean, generally speaking, if you're the sort of person who likes to break social rules all the time, you're going to get in trouble. And it's not going to be that easy to get to the top of an organization and to be wealthy and successful.
If judges, lawyers, and police officers do not make the law themselves, how can they be responsible for enforcing it?
Well, I'm not sure that I understand the question. So,
there was a discussion, and the call-in host said, "All right, officer, thanks for calling in. Is there anything else that you'd want to tell the people about being an officer?" And he basically said, "I don't make the law; I just enforce it." I'm trying to think of the most charitable way to ask that question, which is, if judges, lawyers, and police officers don't make the law, how can they be responsible for enforcing it? They're not Congress.
Right. I mean, you know, like, well, I mean, the people who are enforcing it have to be different, right? Because, like, Congress doesn't have time to go around enforcing everyone. Plus, like, many of them are like old men, and the criminals would just beat their asses and run away, whatever. But I mean, you know, you have a question about whether you should take moral responsibility, right? Like, I guess the police officer is trying to avoid moral responsibility and say, like, he's not responsible for the consequences of his actions because somebody else decided what the rules would be. So, you know, and I'm just like mechanically enforcing what other people tell me to enforce. But I mean, that doesn't really avoid responsibility. I mean, it's like, well, you chose to be the enforcer of these laws. So, right. And it's, I mean, you know, you have free will, you're not a puppet. It's not like, you know, like this justification would work if, like, you know, the politicians were standing there, like, controlling him with some kind of mind control device that was implanted into his brain that stops him from making independent judgments. But, you know, sadly, we don't have this technology. So, right. And it's like, you know, like, one justification might be, oh, well, I'm going to get fired if I don't enforce the law. So, I mean, that makes some sense, right? But if it's like you getting fired versus somebody going to prison for multiple years unjustly, I think you should take the hit. Just like, you know, imagine like the mafia person saying, well, you know, I don't make the mafia policies, I just enforce them. So, you know, don't blame me. Like, I had to murder this person because the boss told me to, but don't blame me because, like, it wasn't originally my idea. You know, that would fall flat, right?
Who is more morally culpable, the police officer for enforcing the law or politicians who write the laws or do not repeal them?
Yeah, good question. I mean, you know, I guess like the politicians get more blame because, I mean, like they're imposing a rule on a large number of people, and the police officer is only imposing this injustice on a small number of people. So you could say that. You know, and like in my mafia analogies, who's more responsible, the hitman or the mafia boss who ordered the hit? Boy, you know, they're both really bad. I don't know. Like, maybe the mafia boss gets like a harsher sentence. I don't know. Just because the guy at the top should get the bigger sentence.
When looking at all of the shortcomings in the justice system, you can look that almost any system has shortcomings. As Thomas Sowell likes to say, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. Knowing this, that instead of maybe having a goal, we should embrace a certain system to increase the likelihood of getting a desired outcome. What is a type of system we should embrace to have the best justice system possible?
Well, I guess, I mean, you know, my real ultimate view is anarcho-capitalism. So ultimately we should do that, right? Ultimately we should privatize the courts. In fact, well, you know, like we don't have to go all the way to anarchy. We should privatize the courts and the police. And that could be done without becoming, you know, a fully anarchist society, right? So, and what do I mean about privatizing the courts? So, you know, right now there are private arbitrators that resolve some disputes, and particularly in civil cases. So like if you have a dispute with your credit card company, there's probably a clause in your contract with them that says that it will be resolved by arbitration. And the reason for that being that it's a lot cheaper and faster, right? And maybe more reliable, at least as reliable, right? You know, it gives you about the same results. So we could expand that. There's a small number of cases in which government courts will refer you to a private arbitrator. This happens in some automobile insurance disputes, but we could expand that. We could have more and more cases where the government outsources it to private arbitration. I think this could even be done for criminal cases. I don't see why not. Okay, now you can't, I think, you know, like we can't do that 100% because there's a constitutional guarantee on a right to jury trial. Well, I guess there could be a private jury trial, right? It can't be all arbitrators. So, but you know, you could outsource it to a private company that conducts jury trials. What would be the reason for doing this? Because it would be cheaper and faster, right? And a lot of times people are just stuck waiting and waiting. Like sometimes people are waiting in jail for months, in some cases years, to get their trial. Like in some cases you wait in jail awaiting trial until longer than the sentence you would have gotten if you were convicted. There are a few cases where that happened. All right, so, you know, yeah.
What do you think are some of the benefits of having a jury of your peers, people that every so often are called for jury duty, versus having professional jurors, people who go through skills and training, and their job is to be on juries? Do you have any thoughts on the costs, benefits, and which one might be superior?
Yeah, I mean, the professional juries would probably be better at evaluating factual evidence and better at understanding the law for obvious reasons, right? So like, well, they would probably get some training before becoming professional jurors. And then more importantly, they would probably have a lot of experience with trials. So you wouldn't have to worry about somebody just not understanding the evidence in the trial. I think there's at least some risk that the professional jurors would become sort of too attached to the state, right? Because like at that, if you're a professional juror, then basically you're a government employee at this point, right? Because they're the only ones who run trials. So you're a government worker. And then I think when you become a worker for the government, you start to identify with the government. And the thing is like the main reason why we wanted juries in the first place was to check the government's power. We wanted people who would not necessarily sympathize with the state in case the state is abusing its power and, you know, making too many laws.
Because people see democracy as being an extension of the society, being an extension of the individual, you'll very often hear, we live in a democracy, you don't like it, work to change it. And ultimately, if you don't like that, well, then you just need to leave and go do your own thing. Is this a justified response to people like you who just do not appreciate the law?
Yeah. No. Right. You know, like, so work to change the law. I mean, sure, that's a fine thing to do. But, you know, in the meantime, what do we do? So, if there's a particular case, so like there's a particular person who's been arrested for a drug crime. And then, you know, if you're on the jury and I say, oh, you should vote to acquit because, you know, drug laws are unjust. Okay, and then somebody says, no, no, you shouldn't vote to acquit. You should work to change the law. Well, okay, so if I vote to convict and then I go out and start lobbying to change the law, that guy's still in prison. How does that help him? Right? And then, you know, and then what's the probability that I actually succeed in changing the law? I don't know, 1 in 1,000,000, maybe 1 in 100,000. I mean, like if I'm wealthy or something, maybe I have a better chance. I don't know. Like if I'm a billionaire, then I have a better chance. But anyway, you know, the probability is still like very small. It's got to be under 1%, right? So how is that like a viable alternative? Like, you know, if the law is on, and by the way, you know, when people say, oh, you don't like it. No, it's not that I don't like the drug laws. It's that they're violations of people's individual human rights, right? Like, I mean, I don't use drugs, so I don't, what is it to me? It's not like, there's no skin off my nose. It's just that I recognize that other people have rights. The drug users have rights, you know? It's not that I love the drug users or whatever. But anyway, so You know, the phrase should be, if the law is unjust and is causing an enormous amount of unjust harm to people, then still enforce it, but work to change it. That's a terrible idea. You know, then continue doing the injustice and then do some other thing that will have no effect on it. Like, how's that a solution? And then the alternative solution is, oh, well, you know, vacate the country. Okay, well, tell me where I can go, where I will not have a government that makes unjust laws, right? Like, what country can I go to, right? And how about the government leaves instead, right? Just like, I have a conflict with the government, you know, why don't they leave the country? Because they're the ones who are doing the injustice, right? Like, I'm just like minding my own business and respecting everybody's rights, and they're the ones violating rights. So they're the ones who should have to leave.
And they're always telling me it's about protecting me and serving me. And then I go to cash out on some of this service and they're not interested at all. They tell me to leave. The worst customer service of all time.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, if you try complaining, you know, if you complain to a private company about how you don't like their service, they will do something. They will get some customer service representative on the line who will try to make you feel better. You may or may not be ultimately satisfied, but you're like, frequently they give you your money back. Frequently they give you like free gifts or whatever. They just like try to make it feel good. You go to the police and say, I'm very unhappy, right? Like, you know, you start like chewing them out about how terrible their service is. Like, they'll probably just arrest you. They'll like make up some charge against you and arrest you.
A lot of people would say that order itself is a value, allowing us to plan our lives and our future, increasing the likelihood we can pursue our happiness. Following laws is more orderly than disobeying laws. Therefore, one has an obligation to obey the law.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it kind of depends on what the law is. I mean, so, you know, like if this was the justification, then I guess we shouldn't make any laws that are going to be widely disobeyed because, you know, we want to have order, right? So, I mean, we should repeal the drug laws. Like if your main concern is order, because they're, yeah. But also like just intrinsically, even if it was going to be obeyed, like, well, we could have order, you know, with people obeying the laws if the laws were different from what they are. So, you know, maybe we shouldn't have these laws. But anyway, the other thing is like, okay, does this outweigh people's rights, like not to be unjustly imprisoned? So, you know, like when somebody is going to be punished for a crime, the first question we should be asking is this a just punishment? Right. And it's like, okay, so this person is like very slightly marginally diminishing the total amount of order in society because he didn't obey a law. And is that enough of a reason to send them to prison for like a decade, which is like a common thing to happen if you're convicted of a drug crime, right? And you know, and they go up from there, right? You know, there's like cases where it goes up to 60 years or something like that, you know, for selling drugs. I don't know, you know, and it's like, I don't know, a lot of things might be disorderly, right? Like, you know, what if you have purple hair, which is different from the other people around you? Like, that's disorderly. Like, I mean, in a sense, that's true, but, you know, like, is that a reason to imprison people? I see the reason to imprison people if they're actually hurting other people. But if they're not hurting other people and all they're doing is just like, they're being disorderly, like they're not doing the same stuff as the other people, like, this doesn't seem like enough of a reason to imprison them.
Yaron Brook of the Iran Institute has an objection to your work, saying that chaos would exist as a causal result of there not being a monopoly on violence. You'd have competing firms with no objective standards, therefore constantly subjective standards leading to conflicts, leading into a war of all against all. How do you respond to this critique?
Yes, I mean, this is totally implausible. So, I mean, first, you know, what the Randians are always saying is, oh, you know, we need objective law, but they don't give any argument for why the judgment of people in the government is going to be more objective than the judgment of people in private firms, which they don't believe about any other area, right? Like if the government was making shoes, they don't think that the government shoe company would make better judgments than the private sector shoe companies. That would be more in line with reality or whatever. But anyway, okay. But, you know, leaving that aside, there's another argument, which is, well, there would be conflict among these protection agencies, which David Friedman, you know, responded to effectively a long time ago, right? So it's not profitable to be at war with other agencies all the time, right? And if you think about it in terms of like real human beings, so there's this protection agency that's advertising jobs. And what they're saying is, okay, so we need you. We're looking for people to come join us to go have a battle with the other protection agency, right? So, you know, you come to the job, you know, you're gonna be fighting another agency that's a lot like us, and they're gonna be shooting at you, and you're gonna be like murdering. We hope that you will be murdering the other security guards, but they might also murder you either way. Anyway, so come work for us. Right? Like, just thinking about actual human beings, it's going to be hard, right? And so like what the security agencies would want to do is negotiate agreements with each other. They would want to like come up with an agreement on who's going to arbitrate disputes between their customers, right? But I mean, this is all like, you know, this is discussed in the literature on anarcho-capitalism, like, you know, it goes back for a long time. In the present book, I didn't want to assume anarchism. So, you know, even though I made these remarks, you know, just, you know, a little while ago about how we should privatize the justice system, like, you know, I want to say we could do that, and we could have a government, but still, like, you know, outsource most or almost all of the court cases to private arbitrators.
What does content independence mean, and why is it important?
Yeah, content independence is, I mean, in the context of discussing authority, it's said that the government's authority is content independent. It means something like they get to enforce the law and we have to obey it regardless of what the law says and regardless of whether what the law says is actually a good idea in particular, right? So like, you know, my view is there's a content dependent obligation, which is if the law is just, and like what it says is something that, you know, it makes sense and it's not violating anyone's rights, and like this is what people should be doing, then you should follow it too, right? You know, like, you know, if you recognize that this is a rule that should be imposed on everyone else, then you should also follow it. But the content independent obligation is you have to follow the law even if you think the law is substantively wrong. Right. And I just don't see like the basis for that. Right. So like sometimes, so people will say things like this. And by the way, like, here's a misconception that people have, like when I'm saying this stuff about doing justice, the misconception is that nobody knows what is just or unjust. And like the reason why we have unjust decisions is that the people who imposed them thought they were just. So that is, that's sometimes the case, but actually that is often not the case. Often we have people doing stuff that everyone agrees is unjust. Like there's no case to be made. There's like not a reasonable dispute. And the reason is that it's an implication of a law that was made a long time ago by people who did not see the case that this was going to be applied to. And then now people are imposing what is obviously even to them an unjust decision because they're just like rote following the rules, right? So an example of this is like, you know, a guy getting sentenced to 70 years in prison for stealing a tuna fish sandwich from a Whole Foods market in Austin, Texas. This is a real case. The defendant is Larry Dayries, if you want to look him up on the internet, right? And so like, It was not that the judge thought, yeah, 70 years for stealing a tuna fish sandwich, yeah, that seems about right. That seems like a proportionate punishment. Nobody thought that, right? It was just like a long time ago, or well, I mean, I don't know when, but sometime previously, they had passed some kind of habitual offender statute that said, you know, if you have like a third felony conviction, you get some super high sentence. Okay. And this guy had two previous felony convictions, but they weren't really thinking of that particular case, right? Like, I bet that even the legislators who voted for that law, if they looked at this case, they would agree that was an unjust sentence.
When you ask someone about should the founders of America have followed the law, since following the law is so good, they'll say, well, no, that was a monarchy. That's obviously wrong. It's just some guy, you know, calling out commands. We're talking here about democracy, something very superior. In response to this, one of your many objections you refer to as the rational ignorance of Democratic voters. What is the rational ignorance of Democratic voting?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the fact that most voters don't know what the hell is going on. So, I mean, this is repeatedly found in surveys of public knowledge, right? Like, you know, academics who survey the public to find out what they know about politics are regularly just, you know, struck by how they know almost nothing, okay? So, like, you know, here's a couple of examples. Most Americans don't know what form of government they live under. So, like, there's a survey in which you're given the choices: direct democracy, republic, oligarchy, or confederacy. And most Americans cannot figure out which one of those the United States is, right? Another one is most Americans can't name the three branches of government. There's only three of them. You know, this is literally the least that you could possibly know about the structure of the government. And the other one is the least that you could know about the government that you have. So anyway, so these people are, they're the ones who are making the decisions, right? They're deciding who gets in office. And then the politicians have to pander to them in order to get elected and then get power to make rules for everybody else. That was explaining the ignorance part. I didn't explain the rational part. The reason for this is it's not an accident. It's built into the system, right? So if you have a large society and you have a large democracy, everybody knows that their vote makes no difference. Right? More precisely, everyone knows that the probability of their vote changing the outcome of an election ever is extremely small. It's negligible. And for that reason, it just doesn't make sense to expend resources trying to make sure that you vote well. Right? And so, like, you know, so they just basically don't expend any resources on it. By the way, notice how this is different from juries. If you're on a jury, you know that you actually can influence the outcome. You're sitting there talking to the only other 11 people who are making this decision. So, like, you know, you have, for one thing, there has to be a unanimous decision. So you have the power to hang the jury by yourself, even if nobody else agrees with you. But for another thing, you actually get to talk to every other person who's making a decision. So, like, you actually have a chance to be heard. And this just is not the case in an election with millions of voters.
One of the classic examples given in law is that you have a grandfather who wants to incentivize his granddaughter to go to college. So he says, I will pay for your college, but I'm not just going to give you the money. You have to go do the 4 years. Once you graduate, then I'll reimburse you. And 2 years in to her college, the grandfather decides that he's no longer really interested in paying the tuition. He sees a lot of college professor videos going wild on TikTok and says, no, I'm not going to pay anymore. Now, should he be legally obligated to give her the money that he promised her?
I'm not sure. I guess I would say he should have to pay for the amount that she's done so far. I think maybe he should not pay for the rest of it. And then she could decide to continue or not, I guess. Right. But in contract doctrine, there's a principle that there has to be consideration, meaning that both parties have to have done something for each other. And in this case, it sounds like the college student doesn't do anything for the grandfather, like he's not receiving a benefit. I mean, unless you have a weird thing, like he received an emotional benefit. However, I would say, yeah, but he still caused her to take on costs, which maybe she wouldn't have taken on. So, you know, like if you cause somebody to take on costs by making them a promise, you know, then you have to either fulfill the promise or compensate them for the cost that they took.
There was a 2014 case where a woman sued CBS because there was a Dexter poster. This is a show about the serial killer. And she saw it when she was walking down the steps in, I think it was New York City. She was very taken aback by the crude image. It's not, I'm sorry to laugh, but she fell down the stairs and she hurt herself and then tried suing CBS for, you know, crude images or indecent exposure because it was such a foul image to be displaying in public. You think anything like crude images or something like that could be justified in being outlawed?
You know, now you're making me want to look up this poster and see how bad it was.
It's just the one where his face is being suffocated like he's being put into, you know, a morgue.
I see. Yeah. I assume that case was dismissed.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the correct outcome. I mean, in this case, because that's not, it's not a predictable outcome of putting up that poster. Or in fact, I mean, I'm sure they didn't even put up the poster. They just made the poster and sold it, I guess, or gave it away. So, but you know, you couldn't expect somebody to fall down the stairs because of your poster, right? And by the way, also it could happen with lots of posters that are not crude or whatever, not violent or whatever. So, I mean, you could probably think of some cases where I would accept suing somebody for the poster, but like maybe if you're like not only you're making them, but like you're putting them up in a mental institution where it's going to trigger reactions from the crazy people or whatever, like, you know, maybe then you could be sued for that. You know, it's like it'd be something of a stretch, right? It has to be a weird case.
Well, and then, you know, this is obviously the next thing after that is, well, is flashing someone or sending nude images something that should be either illegal or sometimes it, as immoral as it is, it's just not worth making illegal because the justice system isn't worth going through as a method to compensate. So the power of private companies giving us a block button and a mute button is much more powerful than the state getting involved. As far as something like indecent exposure in that realm, would you say that that is inherently unjust?
I mean, I want to say no, it's not unjust, but I haven't thought it through. Like, so I'm not sure that I have a good explanation of why. But I mean, I think that. Like a person exposing themselves right in front of you is more threatening than seeing a poster. So like you can't reasonably really be afraid of the poster, but you can actually reasonably be afraid of that guy. Mm-hmm. And you know, partly because like if he's doing that, then he doesn't care about social rules, which means that who knows what he's going to do next, right? But I guess I kind of think like people shouldn't be forced to look at you like if they don't want to. But you know, like I don't actually know what happens in the status quo. So like I would think like giving a person a ticket or a fine, I think that's okay. I don't think I wouldn't put somebody in prison for that. Because I just think like, by the way, like if you think people should go to prison for that, like you might not realize what the prison system is like, right? It's like, it's very harsh. It's like a big deal to be sent to prison, right? Like, you know, you have a good chance of being beaten and raped, you know, while you're in prison by the other prisoners and the guards also. So, you know, it's like, I mean, resorting to the justice system is the way that it currently is like a big deal. Like don't do that unless there's something very serious. Don't call the cops on someone unless they've done something pretty serious.
Final question. Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker made a big splash when they said, I have the Washington Examiner article here. Buttigieg thinks it should be legal to knowingly give someone HIV. Not exactly the whole story. Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker basically said that you should not have to tell your sexual partner if you are HIV positive, because there this creates a terrible stigma, disproportionately hurts people of color. Therefore, no, you should not be liable for something like that. Would you say that someone is aggressing against another person if they have sex with them, knowing they are HIV positive?
Yes.
Yeah.
The thing is like, okay, so, and why would you not want to disclose this? Well, the reason you wouldn't want to disclose it is that then the person would not want to have sex with you. Right. Okay. So, well, that means that they didn't have informed consent, right? Like, if the reason you're not telling somebody something is that they wouldn't consent if you told them, that means the consent isn't valid. Right. Like, you know, you have to disclose things that would obviously be deal breakers for a lot of people. Like, if there's a good chance that this is a deal breaker for the other person, you have to disclose it.
The book is Justice Before the Law. Find it on Amazon in the link in the description. Thanks to everyone for watching the Libertarian Institute and Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Dr. Humor, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. Great to be here.